Yo, Camicidal fanboys and fangirls out there across the Camicidal world. Or I guess I'll say across the bleed. So typically there would be a nice little interaction here between myself, RP Wilson, and my illustrious co-host, Lucius Illuminux, where we introduce our What's Up Wednesday guest. And for this What's Up Wednesday, we actually had N. Stephen Harris, one of the creators, co-creators, I guess, of Majala and everything like that, and just a prolific artist and a longtime industry veteran. And what happened was we got into some technical difficulty snags, and we were trying to work through it and really, piece it all together. But the best way to get this content pushed out to you all in a timely fashion was to actually just throw this disclaimer here and just kind of go in and let you know that we're coming in midway through the conversation that we had with Steve, and we were talking more about the how to stay consistent working in the business, working in the industry and things like that, and how and kind of like the timing and the pressures and everything like that that goes on to a publisher, and not even a publisher, but goes on to creative group. And when they're trying to push out content. So really all I'm trying to say is you're gonna come into this conversation midway simply because of the technical difficulties, and I'll just kind of like do a quick rundown of N. Stephen Harris and the great things that he's done. So he's working on a Jala fantastic comic book series, and he's got a couple of other great things that he's been working on. He's been in the industry for a long time. He's done a variety of fantastic pieces, and he's just an all-around great guy. So without further ado, I'm gonna loop it off into the actual conversation that we had with Steve, and hopefully you guys enjoy this, and just as another part of the whole uncut thing and us trying to work through the kinks of this whole remote podcast and remote recording aspect. So I hope you all enjoy this. So that's it. Wilson out.
I guess kind of like back to the Jala real quick, to the story of it all actually. And I wanted to talk about, having the lead character as, as a teenage girl and capturing her voice, making it also a modern, modern time teenage girl, getting her voice down, getting her friend's voice down, and being able to have that true to the times. How were you guys able to actually capture her voice so accurately?
Well, Rob and I both have daughters. As for one, his is a few years older than my daughter. But Rob does his Rob, as mostly Rob's saying, he does his research very well, whatever he writes. So he has his head and ear to the surface of what's going on and how to capture that dialogue and what's going on with people at this time and what's going on. And we're still, and I'm gonna start doing more research, because my role with the plotting is growing. It started growing with issue before, when I plot the first few pages out for that, and I'm doing I've done more plotting or co-plotting with this with the next arc we're doing. So or this graphic novel we're going to do. So we're definitely going to do more research now. Definitely be talking to my daughter more about some things, and so we'll go. It's an ongoing process and ever developing.
Okay, so question on that. How tall is a Jala? Because
Yeah, Charles, I'm
she
5'9".
nine.
gonna be a giant. At least the way I
She's
imagine in my
five,
house,
five.
like, yo,
Yeah, she's a 5'9", 13-year-old.
Wow. 5'9", 13-year-old.
Because I was looking at her height compared to
Yeah.
everybody else, and I was like, yo, she's kind of tall at 13.
Yeah. And she has a friend, her friend, I think it's Kia. She's a little taller than she is.
Okay, I guess the last question before we get to artwork that I had is, you mentioned your daughter a couple of times, and reading the book, family and community seem to be something that really permeates throughout the book. So, I mean, how important is it that you capture that, and How do you capture that from your standpoint as an artist? You know, make sure when we see the pictures, like we see the love and we see those connections.
Oh yeah, because this is something that I want to do. I want to. I mean, I used to be more in touch with the community back in the 90s. I was very involved with issues like in the early 90s. There was the in Harlem. There was, I don't know if you knew of the curriculum of inclusion struggles, where people wanted to get more representation in the history books for Black people. And there was a whole bunch, there's a whole struggle around that. And I was, the struggle that I was involved with revolved around City College in Harlem. Now, I didn't go to City College, but I was involved with the organization of City College that was around those struggles and around the Black Studies Department in City College. And so I was involved with a lot of that going on and and other struggles around Harlem and Brooklyn involving representation and stuff like that. So I want to incorporate some of that stuff in the book of people I know who are in the community doing things, or who have who contribute or have very color, or who have very colorful personalities in the community, whether it's Harlem or Brooklyn. Because I've been in New York since '89, and I live in Harlem. I've been in Brooklyn. I've known a lot of people, whether they're activists, conscious people, or other. So I want to definitely include that mix within the book at some point, and that where they'll fit in within the story.
As Lou said, that permeates all the way through. And the other thing that also permeated all the way through the book and was, you know, a real, not even an eye opener for me, but a thing that I was like, yes, awesome, was, you know, she has a two-parent household, you know, right there. And I was like, yes, because it was like, you know, for me it was like, hey, you know, like here it is, you know, my mom and dad, they're married together. Then it was even more so like my little sister, you know, since I've moved out and stuff like that. That's my little sister right there. My little sister is 14. So it was sort of like, this is a person that I can say, hey, you want to read a new comic book? Check Ajala out. It's basically you.
Nice. Nice. And I always get a big kick whenever, 'cause I know I've talked to kids, and I've done work as a teaching artist too, and I've done a work, I did a workshop last year. I'm gonna do one again through Society of Illustrators, where they have students from art and design come in. And one student had mentioned to me that she likes my art because I draw, she says that you draw Black people like how they really look. And that really touched me. I'm like, yeah, thank you. And so I mean, I, that's what I, I want to do. I want to have, I want to have you connect with it, and I want you to be able to see someone in there that maybe you think is around, that looks someone like someone around the corner, or act like someone on your block or in your neighborhood, or someone you went to school with. And I want to reflect the different shades, different hairstyles we have, different types of styles we have in our rhythm or body language. If I can capture that in the book, with it, with whatever book I do, whether it's Ajala or another book I do, or my other book called, which is called Brotherhood of the Fringe, which is more a more older book and more a sophisticated book with a little more adult material. Not you know, when I say adult material, I mean more political, not necessarily not gratuitous or sexual, but
Right.
yeah.
Sweet,
But
sweet.
Ajala is pretty sophisticated too. So I mean, we say it's for like 10 and up, but we deal with like today's issue. We don't hold back as far as what happens. I mean, we won't get gratuitous or are overly violent. We'll show action, and we'll have issues in there. We'll pretty much come straightforward, because no, when I was a kid, I had things that came straightforward, and I may have understood them at the time, but when I looked at it again, I did, I said, oh, that's what they were talking about. Or maybe there may be a parent there or adult there to help the child go through or guide through the issues that we're trying to talk about in the book.
Right, yeah, no doubt. Yeah, and it's, you know, and it definitely captures that voice and that tone. You can see that it's, you know, it's not pandering to the audience. You know, it doesn't dumb it down for anybody, and I like that a
Sure.
lot. Yeah, which is so fantastic. And I guess since we're like, you know, we're essentially like touching the artwork stuff already, and actually wanted to talk about that, since, you know, you draw Black characters the way that they look, you know, I can, you know, around my corner, basically I could see somebody with, you know, with like dreads and stuff like that, you know. So
right.
that was dope. And then, you know, just looking at the line work that you have and how you lay this out. And I think one of the first things that blew me away was when you had her essentially, you know, do the backflip off the fire escape, and then, you know, catching and I was like, ooh, this is sick. And then catching herself on the, you know, on the bar, kind of like it was uneven bars and like gymnastics. And I was like, man, this is ill.
That type of sequence where it has the multiple motions of the character moving. I first saw that from Paris Cullens when he was drawing Blue Devil back in, I think, 84, 85.
Sweet.
You know Paris Cullens?
No, actually.
You guys know Paris Cullens?
That's a new name.
Yeah,
actually.
He's a vet in the industry. One of the people I was looking at when I was young. His character, you know the character Blue Devil, though, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard of it. Yeah.
Yeah, he co-created Blue Devil along with Gary Cohn, and back in the early mid 80s, and he would do a lot of sequences where the Blue Devil's a very agile character, would do jumps and leaps and acrobats throughout the page. He had multiple figures. He would draw multiple figures to capture the movements Blue Devil was drawing, and I remember looking at that when I was a young artist and say, I want to do that at one point to capture that feel of motion in the character and an acrobat in the character.
I feel like I've read something he was on.
He's still out there.
Even like, because I did like a lot of Crisis Era DC readings. He ever worked Green Lantern or Batman? I don't know.
He might have, but I don't know, but he was one of the books pre-Crisis, the first Crisis. The first Crisis was 85, I think.
Yeah.
And he was, like I said, he was a co-creator of Blue Devil first few issues of that book. And then he did some other stuff with DC, and he's done some Marvel. But he's one of the veterans I looked up to when he was in the business.
We are both talking about like your kinetic and dynamic scene layouts and I work is on point movements and whatnot. You know, not even just the ones like that. You know, the first scene I referenced was the one when Ajala ran down old boy, and then you see her batons crossed and the dude just flying behind, and I was like, yo, that trend was just crazy. And I think that's like issue three, two or three, somewhere in there.
Okay. Yeah, two. She wasn't in costume because she was just training. You saw her training and doing. We saw her back doing basketball and then training with her mentor.
Yeah. And I think the next one that I actually really noticed, and I kind of wanted to kind of catch your thought process through it, was when she when her and Mr. Dennis, they go out on a patrol, and they basically roll up on the vandals that have been out that have been like, you know, spray painting what's it called? What is her name? Mama Sweet's restaurant. Yeah. And you know, like you have her feign the right cross and then like come and then like just follow up with that kick, you know, and I was like, wow.
Yo, something I noticed in that scene, you see like all the details you pick out. How many different hairstyles the brothers had in that alley? Like, I just appreciate that. You have one dude with cornrows, one dude with the tall fro, one with the uptown fade. I was like, okay, variety.
I just want to show our people off sometimes. We do a lot, so I want to show a lot.
I see all your work.
Like, do you just kind of like, when you're going through this process, do you just kind of take in like a 360 view of the environment around you and say, okay, this would be dope here. This person would be good here. This is how I want to, like, you know, this is how I want to transfer what's in my mind on the page right here.
Yeah, I mean, I'll see something in my head when I read the script, and or maybe I have a vision, and I'll do thumbs and thumbs, and if it doesn't feel right, I'll keep working until it feels right, or changing around, move it around until it feels right for the most part. and it makes sense. So sometimes it's just, here's a vision that comes in my head, and sometimes it may take a while.
Nice, nice.
Okay, so this is a random question on the layout art. Have you ever read the manga One Punch Man?
No, I've heard about the animation, but I haven't seen them yet. So, I haven't read the manga. The last manga I read was Sanctuary.
I think you should just like flip through it, just because when reading through Ajala, a lot of it reminded me of that. Except what One Punch Man does that you don't do, which I think might be really cool, is when those motions are happening. So when you have like a several panel fight progression, it'll take it like a single punch or something and turn it in space. Mm-hmm. So one panel you're looking at it head on, one you might be looking at it from a 30 degree angle, and it always rounds back up from looking at it head on, and it creates this real dynamic feel. So if you like just pick one up and don't even read and flip through it, it's pretty dope stuff.
I'll keep that in mind to pick up the One Punch Man manga.
Yeah.
How many books is it into now?
It's not too many volumes, because I think they're only on like chapter 80 something. They publish like 5 to 7 per. And how many of those are in English? I feel like it's only like 5. It's not that deep. Really, it serves as a parody to like the entire shonen genre. And the plot is incredibly simple. But the art is like super stunning.
I mean, I've seen GIFs and little snippets on video that people may post on Facebook or other social media, but I've never checked out the animation itself.
Yeah, a lot of those GIFs for like the manga GIFs are like ripped directly from panel, and that's how the panel shifts views and
stuff. No, I've seen GIFs from the animation, not the manga.
Ah, yeah. See if you can look at GIFs of the manga; they're like just as real.
Right.
While we're staying on the art. Is, you know, like what's your process? You know, you're walk us through your creative process as much as you can share on when you do your layouts and then you do your pencils and your lines.
Yeah, that's no problem. I mean, I'll share everything. It's nothing I want to keep on. It's about sharing and developing what you have and letting people know what you do. I mean, there's no reason for me to hold back on anything like that.
Sweet.
So I get the script. I read the script at least two or three times, and usually I'll take the first section of the script, whether the first scene, whether it's and work on that and do I may do layouts, or I'll do thumbnails of the first close to half the book, or maybe a little more than half. Try to get as much done as possible before I get itchy to do the next level or next stage of the script. Or the sketches. So I'll do like a number of, say it's a 22-page book, I'll probably do maybe 10 to 11 thumbnail sketches, and then I'll develop those sketches. Those sketches may be like 2 to 4 inches or 4 to 6 inches, like two to four to six inches, something like that big. And then I'll make them bigger, maybe like 6 to 9 inches around that size. And I call that a develop sketch. That I probably showed it. I showed it the editor or whoever I'm working with, and from there I'll scan those pages are scanned, and I'll blow them up in Photoshop and print them out on 11 by 17 paper and put them under my drawing board and put the drawing board on. I'll tape the photocopy paper under the drawing board. Put the drawing board on top of the light box and blue line traced my sketches. And then I'll from there I'll do a tighter pencil line over the blue line pencil.
Wow.
Labor of love.
It's a long process. Sometimes now when I was doing Voltron, I kind of abbreviated the process. I did a thumbnail in blue line sketch, real rough blue line sketch. Now we'll tighten up. Now we'll go over with a pencil and tighten up the lines up a little bit and blow up those. I'll blow up those sketches up, and not the larger size developed sketch, just to cut down time. But that's pretty much the process.
Yeah, that's a labor of love indeed.
Yeah, yeah.
So Lulu, what else you got here? You know, what else you got?
Just level of detail, yet focused enough handle. How do you bring that into, like, if I'm going through the book, I know immediately what's supposed to stand out and I can look at that. But if I want to take a step back and look at the page, there's a bunch of other stuff going on in a room. Two people could be having a conversation in the background and ways that feel real natural. How do you go about creating the scene greater than like what's directly happening?
See, that's training right there. That's the difference between talent and skill. One of the things. Talent is what you're born with, is what you have an affinity to do. And sometimes with me, talent can probably rely on whether you're motivated or inspired to do it. Skill is what you fall onto, is what you fall back onto when you're talent, or when you're not motivated, or when you're not in the mood to do it. So, or maybe it's just not you're not inspired, or it's not coming for you. Like maybe you were drawing well, you were in the groove 11 o'clock last night, but 11 o'clock next morning it's not really coming for you like it was last night.
Right.
So where skill comes in is when you know how to sculpt the body or draw the body using shapes, or how to construct a page or composition using tools like perspective, vanishing points, constructing the figure using shapes, lines, using or how to capture a gesture of a figure by just doing a real quick sketch outline, and feeling your way through a composition or a page, and then until the groove or inspiration hits you. Skill is what it was is what keeps you in the game till you get your until you get on your feet. So and I learned a lot of what you're talking about with directing the eye or focusing on a certain in school, when I had a class on composition where the teacher really taught composition. So he just teaches, one of my favorite teachers in school was a school that was large, when I was going there in college. He had several classes. He had a drawing class, and he had like three illustration classes. And each class he had a different focus, because in one class he wouldn't really pay attention too much on the drawing, but focus on your composition and your design of the page. Another class will focus on your statement, or your what you're trying to say as an artist or as an illustrator. And other class will probably be straight drawing class, where there's a model in front of the class. He's worried about you capturing the model in the correct proportions, or however is how he how, however he would see your drawing looking, or accuracy in looking at the model. So that's, I mean, I try to use those skills, composition, perspective, vanishing point, constructing the figure, and just or design to draw your eye or move your eye to a certain focus. And it can be used with those, and it can be used with word balloons too. I would have to design, place the word, do word balloon placement for the letterer, to direct the eye as well. So all that goes in and is a part of storytelling. Now, storytelling is a whole other thing too, which I didn't really learn in college. I learned after college through Dennis Cowan and Michael Davis, the two co-founders, the two founders of Milestone.
Right.
And I was a student of Michael Davis's class while I was still going to school of visual arts. I met Michael when I was my third year in college, through a friend of mine named Victor Silva, who's now an independent hip hop star. But and the day I met Michael Davis was the day I met Dennis Cowan too, because he came by the school where Michael was teaching, which is a little small community school called the Children's Art Carnival. And from there, a few months later, I became Dennis's assistant, and he taught me through some storytelling by giving me a script, an actual comic book script. Now, there was no deadline to it or anything, but that was just getting a script that was written by a comic book writer was so intimidating to me at the time. and my art took a hit because I was so nervous in drawing that, because I was so used to drawing my own writing or my own visions, and now I had to draw someone else's vision and synthesize that onto a page. And the biggest mistake I made, and big mistake a lot of artists make, is trying to envision what the writer has in mind rather than trust what the artist, yourself as an artist, sees, or myself as an artist see on from the writer's writing. So what would you see when the writer is writing this description of action on the page, instead of trying to see what the writer sees? You follow me?
Yeah, right. Totally follow that.
Yeah, so that was something for me to overcome, and I'm glad I had that experience. And a lot of artists should have that experience before they jump into the comic book scene. Because I saw comics being fun and cool, and I could do this, I could do that, I could do this better than this artist can. But then when you get the script and you have a deadline, that's the moment where you're punched in the face. Prior, you have, first you have all these grandiose plans of what you're going to do, and then you get in the ring, you get punched in the face. Now what?
Yeah, you got to either crumble or punch back, parry something. Yeah.
And can you even remember your plan after when you get punched in the face? So thank goodness even with all that behind me, Michael Davis's class, Dennis Cowan's tutelage as his assistant, still I felt flat on my face my first job, because I took on too much, and it was a job that Dennis got me. But fortunately, I had another chance to do it again. I was better for it. It was less work, less pressure, and a little more time. So I was better for that. So that's a long story, a long answer to your question.
That was amazing. I was relishing in the entire story.
Right. Yeah, it was fantastic. And a question
go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh no. So the question I had from that was actually, and you can probably finish your statement after the question, was how do you, as an artist, and then with the artist and the writer, that upfront twosome, because everybody always thinks of, so you got the artist and you got the writer, and of course you got your letterer, and you got everybody like that plays a big part, but that balance, that storytelling balance between artist and writer, typically. How long does it take to strike that balance when you're newly collabing with another another writer?
It's a growing process. I mean, like with Rob and I, he was writing and I was drawing it, and then as we grew into Ajala, I started having more input, and I mean we both had input going back and forth, but it's growing now. To move it back and forth than before, and it's a growing process. The more you're with a writer, I would think, and depending on what the setting is, if it's like, you're working for a company and it's say you're on, you're on say Daredevil, and the writer's the writer, and the artist is the artist, and you get the script, you draw it, and boom, you get it done, and that's it. Sometimes artists will have input, and the writers I've worked with always ask for my input. I usually didn't really have much to say because I know what to, I just didn't know what to add to it as far from that standpoint earlier in my career. And it was stuff that it was like work. I mean, I liked working on those books, but I mean, I didn't really know what to add to that versus something like a Jala, which is something I'm invested in emotionally and mentally. Cause that is something. It's something of a word I can more relate to, rather than like a Aztec story or a Batman story,
Yeah,
right. So it's something I have more an investment in. You familiar with the writer? She passed away, unfortunately, back in 2011. L.A. Banks.
Yes. Did you?
Yeah, she did the Vampire Hunter stories, yeah. Legends. Yeah, she did a limited series that was published by Dynamite, and my best friend Eric Battle knew her much longer than I did. He brought those characters to life when he would do chapter breaks in the novels she wrote. And so then she did a collaboration with Dynamite where they did an adaptation of her novels. Actually, the story took place after her novels, but they were an adaptation of her characters. And I got a chance to draw one of the books in the limited series, which was a 4-issue limited series. And I would have loved to collaborate with her much more with those characters. And but they were so well developed, had such culture and diversity within that mix, from Southern Baptist to African traditionalist to Afrocentric people. And it was a mix in that group. And I drew it once, but I would love to draw it more because it was this, and I'm not even, it was a vampire book. I don't read vampires, but I read her book.
Oh, that's the same. Yeah, because I don't either. And especially when it's like the cover seems weird and it's like a vampire with angel wings. I actually had a friend put me on to that.
Yeah, and then when I read the book, I said, yo, this is deep. And this is, I would love to see it on a movie screen or a TV show or, you know, a TV series. But I mean, I don't know if I answered the question, but just that experience of working with her was great. And I wish we had more time. I wish she had more time on this earth so she could share more of that. I could have collaborate with her a little bit more.
And actually, the question I have following this one is, you know, you talked about, you know, being able to, you know, kind of study under the tutelage of these, you know, amazing writers and stuff like that. And I just wanted to get, you know, like currently, you know, what are the other works that you follow? And like, you know, what are your influences, you know, kind of if you had to pinpoint a couple few writers and artists or even artists that you that you're following currently, and you're saying like, yo, their stuff is good.
Yeah, the artists I'm following now, you know, one of them is Olivia Copio. And whenever he does anything, I want to pick it up. Greg Totini, who did the artwork for that book, The Low. I'm really digging Alex Maleev's work on Lando.
Okay.
I read Saga like everybody else does.
Yeah, Saga is sick.
So I still haven't picked up Saga.
Yeah, and you know, the crazy thing is I also haven't picked up Saga. So you know, as I referenced my little sister earlier on, she fell in love with it because she's a budding artist herself.
Oh, nice.
And yeah, she's fantastic. She's head and shoulders above me. And you know, I mean, I'm no artist, but I can see talent, and she has it. And I gave her Saga as a gift, and she was just blown away by the art, and she, you know, she fell in love with the story and just everything. So yeah, so she sells high on Saga herself.
Yeah. So my other my influence is coming up. My main influence, my first influence, I should say, was probably maybe. I think Arthur Adams. I looked at other artists before him, but my drawing history is a little funny because before high school, I was drawing a lot of spaceships and fighter planes, and then I wanted to draw comics, so I knew I had to draw figures. So I think one of the people I started looking at was Arthur Adams, John Romita Jr. Then Garcia Lopez came into my life, and I really started looking at him heavily, Garcia Lopez and Barry Wintersmith. Then as I became more training to become a professional, was Dennis Cowan, Larry Strowman, still Garcia Lopez, and there's others in that group too. I know I'm blanking on.
Now, well, my question actually here is, you know, what exactly about like Romita Jr.'s work really like grabs you, you know, because sometimes Romita, he's like polarizing to some people. Like some people like loud him, and other people are like,
yeah, I hear that too. It's like either love him or you hate him. Yeah. I love his X-Men and his, especially when Dan Green was inking him. I liked it. And when they were both on their game, I really liked the look of the X-Men. I mean, he was up on the fashion of people. Wearing, I like his interior scenes, his action. It was just so bold and smooth at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And then I liked him even more when he was doing his run on Daredevil. That was an amazing run to me, him and Al Williamson. And the funny thing about that was when I first saw Al Williamson ink him, I wasn't feeling too much because I was more used to Dan Green inking him. And then they kind of started growing together. because they were inking Albert was inked him a couple issues of X-Men, and then I saw them together. Then they did some Spider-Man together, that was pretty good. But the Daredevil stuff they were doing together was phenomenal.
I mean, I saw a couple of the Spider-Man stuff, and you know, because I'm a huge Spidey fan, I'm like, yeah, like you know,
he's had like three or four runs on Spider-Man. He was like on Spider-Man back in the 80s, early 80s, I think late 70s, early 80s. He's on Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. And then he was on X-Men. I forgot what he jumped on after X-Men. This is in the 80s. And then he was on Spider-Man again in the 90s. And got back on the X-Men again in the 90s as well. Late 90s, I think.
It's just, you know, and all that.
Anything he did. He was doing Punisher. He was doing some Punisher books. Punisher Wars on in the mid-90s.
Oh, right. Yeah, he was.
Yeah, Klaus Janson. Then him and Klaus Janson became a team. They did like a limited series with the Eternals, I think. But I think his peak stuff was the Daredevil stuff, I think. Daredevil and the Punisher stuff too, to a degree.
Yeah, I can agree with you on that one too. And then another thing, you know, I always, anytime you bring up Dennis Cohen, I always want to be like, so Dennis Cohen, like he's the man, like like, you know, it's just like, what about Dennis Cohen, you know, just kind of like grabbed you, made you gravitate to his work?
Okay, I guess I got to talk about Michael Davis's class first, then that'll lead into that.
Sounds good.
Michael Davis had a class at the Children's Art Carnival where we had class on Friday and Saturday. Now the Friday class was in the evening, and he had a class of young Black and Latino boys and one girl commit their Fridays to come in and talk about comics. Now came in class, I was like 20. I was my third year. I was like one of the oldest people in class. But Western women were like in 17, 18, 15, 14. And usually people wouldn't hang out there on Friday night, right? So, but he had us coming on Friday night. Especially me, I'm in college on Friday night. I want to hang out.
Yeah.
I'm coming to talk about comics. So, he had the gift of gab where he could sell anything. And somehow he convinced the people at DC to let 10 to 20 young Black and Latino kids into their offices after hours. Wow. On a Friday night into the meeting room and talk about comics. Because he had a class. His class was our mission for the year was to create our own, write and color or paint and write, draw, and paint our own comic book graphic novel.
Ooh.
And have it at the end, have it done by the end of the year. So we started September, October. Have it for May or June and ready for the convention season and shop our graphic novel to editors at the convention. That was a class assignment. And we had to use a DC character and we couldn't use Batman. And the reason why, because that was in 89 when the Batman movie was coming out. When the Batman movie had just came out. I joined his class in the fall of 89. The first Batman movie came out in the spring of 89.
Right.
And so it was Batman Mania. Everyone wanted to be about Batman. And so he said, no Batman. I still drew Batman, but I had Batman getting shot.
Oh.
And Black Lightning was the main character of my book.
Hey, let's go Black Lightning.
And so that was Michael Davis's class. So the first day of the class, Dennis Cowan came in the class. I wasn't much of a Dennis Cowan fan before, but I knew it was working. I didn't hate it, but I wasn't a big fan of his at the time. And then when I saw, you know, seeing a lot of times for us, seeing the pencils is much different than seeing the pencils finished and inked. when I saw his straight pencils, I saw his work in a whole different light. And I became a fan of his work and loved the energy and that his pencils had. I mean, you still see a strong energy in it when it's ink, but I saw more of it when it was pencil, seeing the photocopies of those pencils at the time. And he took a liking to my work at the time and wanted me to be his assistant. And a few weeks to a month or so later, a few months later, I was in the studio, you know, doing some things, whether it's backgrounds or other stuff on, or learning to do comics in the studio.
That's legit. It's pretty dope stuff right there.
Yeah, so he was mean, it was an experience. It was two other artists in the studio. One name was J.J. Birch, and another was a colorist named Noelle Giddings, and she later became the milestone colorist, one of the main milestone colorists on the milestone books.
Clutch, pretty awesome. So Lou, you got any questions for Steve on, you know, on his influences?
Just what does that do for your mentality when you're constantly, you know, being pushed and have these opportunities to work with people who, you know, at the time are really big and they're looking at your artwork? What's it like working during those times?
Wow. It's pretty cool. 'Cause, you know, when I was working with, we had our crew, you know, Children's Art Carnival. So many people who were in the Children's Art Carnival with me, you guys probably know, like Sean Martinborough, John Paul Leone,
mm-hmm.
Adam Polina,
mm-hmm.
Two other guys you probably know, Brett Lewis, who did the Winter Soldier.
Okay.
John Paul Leone, Kevin McCarthy, Walter McDaniels. Felix Serrano, who's a colorist who colored some of Sean's work on oh gosh, what's the book name? What's the book that Sean Martinborough does now with Image and Skybox? I'm throwing a blank on that. But he Felix colored some of my stuff too when I did some work for DC Comics. When I did a Huntress story for DC Comics that was edited by Joe Illidge.
Was that during No Man's Land?
No, that was before No Man's Land. It was in the giant size. Remember when the giant size Batman were coming out, the 8-page giant size Batman, and I did a 10-page Huntress story, where she encountered the Riddler. But she encountered the Riddler. She encountered the Riddler for like 2 pages, and then she had to defuse the bomb that he left in a museum.
Oh, I've read that joint. moment.
Yeah, that was written by D.G. Chichester, and I penciled it. I think Rich Faber inked it, and Felix Serrano colored it. Well, with Walter McDaniels, Walter McDaniels, he's in Hong Kong right now doing animation and having a real successful career in making properties out there in Hong Kong. He had a studio out over here in Queens in the early 2000s where he was doing stuff for Hasbro and other toy companies. And so working in the studio environment is always fun, you know, working with other artists and vibing off of them. Before that, I was in the studio with a bunch of artists, very different energy in Midtown Manhattan with Gregory Williamson, Louis Small Jr., Mashindo Kuwumba, and Chris Walker for a little bit, Rob Stoll for a little bit as well. Rob Stoll's an inker. Chris Walker was a colorist. He colored some Cannon Buster stuff for LaShawn Thomas back in the early 2000s. Mashindo Kuwumba is a fantasy artist and illustrator. There's a lot of which is termed Afrofuturist stuff. But he was doing, yeah. So, and Gray Williamson, who does the Valmore pop right now. You might have seen a little bit of that on Facebook or promoted on Amazon. So I was in studio with those guys from 97 to like 2002, and that was a very good experience. I mean, working with Gray Williamson, I mean, it's like a stage in my career where I was developing as an artist through Michael Davis and Dennis Cowan as a pre-professional, preparing to be professional, and then years later I was a professional with some years experience, and I joined the studio. I still had more to learn. I learned a lot under Gray, teaching me some things about my storytelling and some drawing. And my work just changed virtually overnight in my first couple months in the studio from things I learned from Gray. And then just going on from there, you know, being at Walter's studio and doing storyboards for a little while, and then back in the comics, start being more geared to doing independent work on my own creative own work and track my own stuff out, and going on from there and developing and growing from there.
And I actually had I think you dropped out Joe Ilyich's name in there real quick, and one of the next questions I actually had was about any new things that you were working on. And we on our Twitter account, we caught Solar Man and we were like, oh snap.
That book has like the bomb squad on it. Like, how did you guys all end up on the same book?
Yeah, how'd that happen?
I was geeking. I know I dropped the rest of the group. I was like, yo, Joe Ilyich and Stephen Harris and Andrew Dollhouse are all about to be on the same book.
Joe and I go back. We went to school together back in Schoolbridge Arts. I met him back in school. He was the editor on the Hunter story that I was telling you about. He was editing. He was editing that story in that book. So we have a history. He's always wanted to work with me, and I with him too. So this was something that came along to him, and he saw an opportunity for us to work together and told me about the project. So that's what I'm working on right now. I just did it. So we just finished issue one, which is hopefully due out. Well, not hopefully, but should be. Which will be coming out either in May or June. It's already been solicited by Diamond. So that's coming out. And so I'm about to start issue two. So that's where we are right now with that book. So I'm looking forward to getting started with that and continuing to work with that I'm looking forward to continue working with that book on that book because it's a very fun property to do working on.
So Solar Man, and then we've got the potential graphic novels for Ajala. Anything else that might be kicking around?
Yeah, maybe something in the summertime. There's a person I just met like last year who wants to do a Kickstarter for a certain historical figure fighting stuff. So we'll see what happens with that. He's talking about starting production like in late summertime. So that is what's on the table right now.
I feel you. So Lou, any final questions, comments that we might be missing before we probably close this bad boy out?
Okay. Starting on the closing questions, what makes you say yes to doing interviews with like a podcast like us, this little podcast that could got maybe 20 some odd subscribers, and you've just got this wealth of knowledge, and this is somebody with like industry stain. You know, you're not indie writer or artist trying to come up. And you know, when you said you were willing to do What's Up Wendy, I was like, wait, we said we got who? Is this real right now?
First of all, it's hard to see me in that the type of light. I mean, I'm just here trying to you know, get my grind on. The hustle is always present. Second of all, I'm more of an independent creator now, and I do mainstream work. But I want to do independent work, and we have to get our stuff out there and promote. And we independent creators need podcasters like you guys, whether it's you guys, Fan Bros, Black Tribbles, Black Girl Nerd, whoever else is out there. There's many other Black other podcasts out there to get the word out. So I mean, we can't rely on the mainstream to get our properties out there and recognize. So we need to help each other get recognized and get known, and let our market know we're out there. Because every time I do a convention, whether it's the East Coast Black Age Convention in Philly or the Sean Burk Show or Honest Con or MechaCon out in Detroit, people always come to those shows and say, I never knew you guys existed. I mean, you guys mean Black comic book creators, Black animators doing this stuff. And so when we can't rely on the Marvels and DCs and the publications that cater to Marvel and these DCs to promote us and to push our properties out.
Right. Okay. Yo, that's tough. That's what's up. Mad respect there.
Yeah, I can't be like I'm too big for you guys, and you guys are too big for me. I mean, it's not like it, because I'm not here. Just I mean, if I'm gonna do this, I want the community behind me. Because if I make a statement, I want somebody to have my back. You know, I want to have other people's back too. And if someone comes at us, they gotta know that we have support.
Squad.
We have a following. People, yeah, squad, exactly. We got a squad, right? and that could hurt that could hurt somebody's pocket if they come at any of us wrong. So when I say yes to you guys, I'm saying yes to the community. I'm saying yes to the independent Black independent combo community, and to us getting our voice and word out and artwork out there too.
That is really, really dope. We definitely appreciate that. Because we were hyped as hell.
Well, I'm excited to be on your show, man. It's, I mean, you guys are starting a few months ago or so, or what?
Yeah.
I mean, I was really, really enjoying your show. I mean, it seemed to pick up from the first show to the third show, or fourth show. And it was, I enjoyed listening to, I listened to two or three shows you had on the website. But I hope you guys grow and get bigger and more people listen to you guys. And if I can help that, I'm glad to do it.
Yeah, we definitely appreciate that. Lou, you got anything else? I'm pretty like, hey, awesome high note right there.
Are you going to be at ECBAC this year, East Coast Black Age of Comics Convention?
Yeah, I'll be there this year.
We'll be out there, so.
Yeah, I plan to be there. I plan to be at Honest Con in August, if all things go like they should. I plan to be at MechaCon in Detroit and New York Comic Con in October, and anything else that may come up in between those days. Those are my main target points. And also, there's the Amalgam event, the Amalgam Podcasters event in March 19th.
Okay, we'll be out there too. Yeah, we're on the list.
Okay, I plan to be up there myself.
Yes, we will see you there. Yeah,
great. That's great.
Awesome, fantastic. So
I guess the last thing I got is, you know, taking you a bit back even before the comic career. Seems to all our listeners out there, and Stephen Harris and I are from a place called Union County, New Jersey. We were both about that track life. So, I mean, what I'm wondering is what them times were.
What the times were?
Yeah, and those marks.
Oh, my. Oh, my times were getting lower, but they weren't. Okay, with high hurdles, I had people worried at first, when I first was doing practice for high hurdles, because I was tripping over the training hurdles. And you know how low the training hurdles go, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, because there's an old hurdles which were heavy and they were folded. They folded.
But like the down cross braces?
Yeah, I think. Yeah. Not the ones that were, not the ones that weaveled and wobbled, but the ones that just folded down and broke. And yeah, those are heavy ones. And I tripped over it when it was like down on the ground. And people and the coaches were worried that if I was, and the coaches worried about me just doing these hurdles for a minute. The reason that I tripped was because I was tired, so I wasn't really all there. But that was my first time doing the training for track, my sophomore year of high school. But I became a pretty solid runner, and my time was going down like toward my senior year. But I wish I had an extra year to do it, because if I started maybe in eighth grade, or even freshman year, I probably got down in the low 15s or 14. But I got my lowest time on hurdles was like 15.7, I think.
Okay. That's funny. I got about the same span, but I feel like that same, if I would have started earlier, I would have peaked, because I started like my sophomore year. I was hitting like...
Oh, you too.
Yeah, so I was hitting like a 15.2, which my year and the year after me, it was just like I was getting the finals. I might get points, but that wasn't meddling. My main event was the 100. Me and hurdles, that started out pretty bad as well, but my reason for running hurdles is my main event was the 100. So sprinters or hurdlers only had to do half a sprint workout. And our hurdle coach was the head football coach. So when he told me to come hurdle, I was like, you mean I don't have to run 450s? Okay, that's cool. And then I wasn't nice at hurdles to the moment I absolutely busted my butt. And like the indoor hurdle season, It was like an epic fall, because my lead leg went under the hurdle. I slid. The hurdle was bouncing on my back.
Ooh.
And
oh my goodness.
I had like this big bloody left leg. And I was out of practice for 2 days and I came back. But I was out of practice because of the trainer and the blood. Like me actually falling at that moment, I was like, you know what? Falling isn't that bad. And then like within the next 2 weeks, I exponentially improved and started coming down nice. From there.
See, I didn't do winter track. Like, so indoor was a winter.
Yeah.
Yeah, I never did winter track. I never did that.
It's funny because I didn't do that till my junior year. So my sophomore year, I started in the spring. And I knew my coach So I didn't go to Rahway High School, but I did sports there. I went to like Union County Vo-Tech. So I would that my sophomore year after I played football and my coach wanted me to run winter track, I just did not go into the high school all winter. Like I would get off my bus and turn away from the high school and walk home to avoid it. And then I hit that spring track my sophomore year and was like, you know what? Maybe winter won't be so bad.
Yo, those practices were rough though. The pyramids.
That is the exact least favorite workout. I used to almost always do those on Wednesdays, work day Wednesday.
Oh, okay. We had those like before the tracks, before the meet started. But like maybe if there was a meet, like the two practices after a meet were the hardest practices, and the easier practices were like the practice before the meet. Now the pyramids, for those people who may not understand, is like doing the one. It's like all around track: 100, 200, 300, 400, 400, 300, 200, 100, and those were killers. And the two 400s back to back were killers.
Yo, that just brings back so many memories. Yep.
And one time I messed around and made pancakes before going to track practice. I went to track practice and threw them all up.
Yeah, there'd be times I just almost died, 'cause
Oh, yeah.
I was an asthmatic, and pyramids and 450s, or I still am an asthmatic, but pyramids and 450s were the workouts that it showed. Like I would be utterly KO'd after pyramids. Like people would be clearing the track going home, and I'd be like, I'm going to lay here for like 20 minutes and then get up and go home.
Oh yeah, I remember the day after my first track workout, and I had to go. It was on a Saturday, and on Sunday I had to go to work, and I was a bus boy, so I had to be on my feet all day.
Ooh, man.
And I got out of the bed, I fell down. I never felt pain like that in my life. I mean, my calves felt like rock. Everything was so. I never felt that kind of stiffness before in my life.
Yeah, my first tough workout I didn't even finish. So I always remember mine too, but it's because I got sent home.
Oh, shucks.
Like I my ass was actually we were running Kansases, so like 150, then an exercise 150, then go, then the second set came, and I started using my hair after like every single 150, and they were like, go home, you'll get this try again tomorrow. And I was like, go home? What do you mean? You're like, come back tomorrow. And I was like, what? And I was like, I can't get sent home anymore.
How many days a week did you practice? You practice 6 days a week or 5 days a week?
So it was five until peak season. So once we started the conference, county, states, etc., it got to six. But early season, it was five.
It was always six for us.
Yeah, once you heard the phrase peak season workouts are coming, you're like, oh, there goes Saturday. There goes Sunday. Ah, it's over.
We had Sunday off, thank goodness, but yes, that we had Monday through Saturday.
But that's good times. Good, like, for people who don't know, at least I didn't find this out till I got that county record of 55 and they put it in the paper. Within New Jersey, Union County, it's known as Speed County. So me and Steve are from that county where we be moving.
Oh, it's known, really, it's known as Speed County?
Yes.
Wow, I never knew that. Because that go there was Plainfield there, there was Elizabeth.
Plainfield, Elizabeth, Rahway, Linden, West.
Westfield, was Westfield good when you were there?
Westfield had throwers. They had
Okay,
throwers
because
for days.
Westfield had a track guy named McGordy, and I was there, and we all feared him. He was a white dude that was burning track. He was burning the high hurdles in particular. That's what he was burning.
Oh man, there was
And
a 7 foot dude from Summit, which is also Union County. Yeah. Oh man, what was that dude's name? There was this dude who my entire senior year, or he was not 7 feet himself, he was like 6'8", and he just sounded like a giant too. And I would go out and somehow get placed, probably because our PRs were really close, except he would just always beat me, and I would be real intimidated standing next to somebody like 9 inches taller than me. tall white dude just walking over hurdles. I always was like, yo, if I can just get a lane two over from this guy, maybe I would PR again. He's out here busting like a 14-7. How the heck do I always end up next to him in prelims?
And he was coordinated like that to be 7 foot and do hurdles.
Yeah, he was pushing for the state high jump record, which apparently his dad set. So he was constantly at like 7 foot, and his dad's record was like 7'2.5", and he was out there high jumping against his dad all year. And his hurdle,
his hurdles were like, wait, so he was fighting against the past, really?
Yes, he was fighting against the past.
He wasn't even looking at you then, huh?
No.
Wow.
Injury, right?
Great times.
Yeah, they were fun. They were fun. Yeah, I joined track because I didn't make the baseball team. And I said, I still had time to make the go off the track, and I made track. I said, okay, cool.
Yeah, my dad encouraged the switch, even though I didn't do it my freshman year. My dad was a baseball guy, and though he'll probably never admit it, I think he was kind of disappointed that since I'm fast, I was always outfield. Fielding wasn't a problem. Once pitches stopped being more than fastballs, I stopped picking up ball movement. So, like, my 8th grade year, all of a sudden, spring came around, and I wasn't going to baseball practice. I was like, Dad, what's the deal with baseball? Season starting late this year? And he was like, we need to have a talk. I don't think baseball is your thing. But you're athletic, and there is a sport out there for you.
I was awful in baseball, too. I was good in the recreation league. I was decent in there. But when the Babe Ruth league came, and they had the more developed pitchers, I was striking out every time. I was a good fielder, and I could steal some bases, but I couldn't get on base.
Same story. We're like athletic kin right now.
It's like we have athletic ability, but I couldn't catch the ball movement on the ball.
Exact same problem. When I was fine up to that point, I just hit the wall.
And I was great in tryouts. I was hitting the ball in the field. I was doing great in tryouts. But when it came to the real game, I was like, I was striking out.
You know, I don't even know if my cousin recognizes this. Like, my entire baseball career ended. My last baseball game ended with me being struck out by my cousin. He probably don't even remember. My cousin went on to pitch in high school. My cousin went on to play multiple positions in high school. And my career ended with him striking me out that last game of the season.
Oh man!
The thing about the team I was on, we made the we. I think we won the championships too, but it was I wasn't helping. I wasn't much help. I mean, I made a spectacular catch in the field one time. I scored a couple runs, but that was because I was a pinch runner.
Did your part.
Yeah. I mean, I was running back on a ball that was hitting left field that they think I was gonna catch. I ran it down. I tracked it down and caught it. Thank goodness my speed. Thank goodness, I think that was 8th grade. That was in 8th grade at the time.
Yeah, 8th grade was when it stopped. But before me, since I was like, I guess, learned fast. So at first, because I'm left-handed, they wanted to stick me at first. And after that didn't work out, I was playing center field. You know, when you grow up and you got like the machine pitch leagues, nothing was coming out there. Then I remember I bumped up the fast. And all of a sudden, I was running like every other play. I was like, where was this when I started playing outfield?
Right.
Yeah, man. Yo, this interview is like a podcast highlight, I think, even if we get bigger, for me at least.
You and I, no doubt, quite right. So we got anything else that we wanted to touch on?
Yeah, I guess I'll reiterate what I'm doing this year with this, as far as the convention schedule and maybe the event schedule too. So, on March 12th, I won't be tabling at this event, but it's a Women in Comics show in the Bronx, New York, in the Bronx Library. I'll be there at the end of the show. So if anyone wants to come out and say hi to me, I'll be there. And definitely support the people out there doing women, the ladies that do comics or the female characters in comics, or people doing female characters in comics, come out to the Bronx. And come check out that event at the Bronx Library on March 12th. That's organized by Regine Sawyer, who does comics, who's a writer for comics itself. She does Rippers, Ice Witch, and Eating Vampires. And I may be probably doing KidsCon in April as well. It's in the Bronx. I forgot which date that is, but if you do a search for KidsCon, that's being run by Alexander Simmons, who's another independent artist or creator, who's a creator of Blackjack. That's Alexander Simmons, who also does the Kids Comic Con out in the Bronx. And in May, there'll be ECBAC on May 21st in Philadelphia. I'll definitely be tabling there for sure. So come check that out. And then jump to there may be something between May and June. Maybe doing a convention in White Plains, New York on June 4th. And in August, I'll be in Atlanta. I may be in Atlanta for OnyxCon in August. I forgot the date for that, but it's in mid to late August. Then there is, I think it's September 19th. I'm not sure, but it's around that time, between 17th, 18th, and 19th, one of those dates, there will be MechaCon out in Detroit. And then after that is New York Comic Con in early October. Could be more events added to the show. So this is all events I'm doing pending any updates. So it's check out Women in Comics March 12th. In April is KidsCon. I think late April is KidsCon. ECBAC May 21st. White Plains Comic Convention on June 4th. OnyxCon in late August. MechaCon in September, and New York Comic Con. Also the Amalgam event in Philadelphia on March 19th.
We will definitely catch you at some of these events.
That sounds dope.
Sweet.
And people can reach me through social media. I'm on Twitter at nstephenharris, Tumblr nstephenh, Instagram at nstephenharris, of course on Facebook, nstephenharris on Facebook, and there's a Java page. A Java series of adventures on Facebook, and I have a Facebook page called NS Works, which is my artwork in general, from storyboards to comic book work. Check out my, and I have a website. I'm on DeviantArt as well, and stephenharris.deviantart.com.
Sweet, sounds good. So it was an absolute pleasure having you on tonight, and you know.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're very welcome. I mean, we were just thrilled, and we're gonna always keep our ears plugged, and you know, looking out for all this new stuff that'll be coming down, and you know, we'll be seeing you at a couple of these cons too. So, Kamisato fanboys and fangirls out there across the Kamisato world, as always, I'm RP Wilson with my co-host Lucius Luminux, you know, and our What's Up Wednesday with N. Stephen Harris was a fantastic success, and you can reach us at, you know, kamisadotheehawks@gmail.com. check us out on Twitter at kamisadotheehawks, and that's all we have tonight. Peace.